Okay, so today we have a very special guest, Roman Stanek, CEO and founder of Good Data. Roman is a serial entrepreneur and he's originally from Czechoslovakia, but today he's based right here in Silicon Valley, in the heart of Silicon Valley, and is doing a very impressive company, Good Data, that is probably going to be a unicorn company. I don't know yet what your current valuations and so forth are, but it certainly has all the unicorn characteristics that we tend to notice. So Roman, welcome, and I'm so glad you could make it today.
Excellent, thank you. It's good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you, absolutely. So Roman, you are, you're a serial entrepreneur. You first started a company that did not get to 1 million in revenue, but was sold for $10 million to Sun, and you were still back in Czechoslovakia at the time. Then you started another company that did get to $1 million in revenue, and you sold it for $100 million to HP. Good Data is your third company, and you provided the first $2 million in angel investment yourself. Of course, most entrepreneurs do not have the luxury of providing $2 million in angel investment to their companies themselves, but I think you, your track record and your the way you have navigated your entrepreneurial journey has some lessons for our entrepreneurs who are very young or who are just starting out with their first businesses. And the question that I want to put to you as a first question is, do you agree that for a first-time entrepreneur, it pays to do a venture that may not be a unicorn but provides opportunities for learning, and if they're successful, they can, you know, generate significant cash to go after something bigger?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, first of all, when I started NetBeans in 1997, the whole concept of unicorn valuation, billion-dollar valuation, actually didn't even exist. So this is fairly new thing. And, you know, I absolutely agree that it's really the goal should not to be, you know, get to a unicorn. The goal should be to get to a good company, and then if it turns out to be a unicorn, that's actually amazing. You can say that I always wanted to build a unicorn, and you know, I failed twice. But you can also look at it the other way, which is you know, that I'm kind of, these are stepping stones for me to get to a real outcome. And if you see, you know, some people are, you know, some people can go and start Facebook as their first startup and get to a unicorn. Other people need a couple of companies to get there. I don't think, and I actually don't even believe that you need $2 million to go and start a unicorn. It's probably more about experience and kind of, you know, working on the right opportunity and having the right timing. So building multiple startups actually helped me to get to the right timing with Good Data, because 10 years ago, I clearly couldn't have built anything like Good Data.
Right, and I think what you're saying is exactly what we heard from Fred Luddy last week, who is the founder of ServiceNow. And Fred, you know, built almost $40 million worth of revenue with just $2 million worth of capital. And even before they started raising capital, he had validation with customers and so on and so forth. So this actually gives us a good segue into the second question that I want to ask you, which is, we've talked previously about how you zero in on a market opportunity by immersing yourself in customers. Can you double-click down on that process and share with our audience some repeatable methodology nuggets? What comes first, intuition or customer feedback? Which is more important?
That's a tough question. You know, only 5 years ago, people would have said, "Oh, customer, you know, customer feedback is 100% of success. If you're not customer oriented, you know, you're not successful." And then Steve Jobs came with the iPhone, and nobody wanted iPhone, and he was successful. Now people say, "Well, look, it's if you only rely on customer feedback, we would still have faster horses." You know, so it's I don't think it's one is better than the other. I actually do believe that intuition is absolutely critical to start a company and the major decisions that you know, entrepreneur needs to make with a limited amount of data and sometimes almost against the wills of the customers, because the customers have different priorities than the entrepreneur. But at the same time, you know, nobody can build a successful company at a scale without actually, you know, hitting on needs of the customers. And what's actually new, what happened in the last couple of years, especially with subscription services like Udata, it's not only about the initial customer feedback, it's the ongoing experience, you know, going back to the customer. You know, Udata just this year, we won the Stevie Award for the best customer support, and that's part of my customer insight, having the best customer support team that can go not only to the new customers, but also to existing customers and help them to get better experience, but also help us to get more information how these companies, you know, what they actually expect from us. So intuition on one hand, and then on the other hand, investment into customer processes, customer advisory board, award-winning technical support or customer support, that's all part of the kind of the customer journey.
So could you take us back to when you were starting Udata? What was your fundamental intuition, and what was the fundamental nugget that the customers gave you when you went out to validate that intuition that brought it all together for you?
Yeah, so when we started, you know, my intuition was that, you know, as the world is moving to the cloud, the data will be moving to the cloud as well. That data will not be stuck behind the firewall, on premises, and so on. That at some point we will see the world where one of the main assets that people will actually have in the cloud is the application data or company's data. And you know, that was not obvious. I spoke to analysts and they said, no, this, you know, that's never going to happen. Nobody will ever give you data. Initial VC meetings didn't go well because the VC said, no, why would anybody upload their data? So people didn't get a point that, you know, you don't need to upload data into the cloud in the world where data will be actually created in the cloud with applications like ServiceNow and Salesforce and so on. So that was kind of my intuition was that, you know, it would work. And then, you know, we built the first version of the product very early in 2008. And, you know, we went to first customer. It happened to be one of the cloud pioneers, one of the leading customers of Salesforce. And they, when we came, you know, to visit them with a new product, it was the first beta of the product. They essentially said that's exactly what they expected to happen in the world. They paid us money. They gave us lots of feedback. They helped us to promote the company. And essentially, the first year, we were kind of relying on them to be primary marketing channel because they wanted to be successful with us, and they had the same intuition and the same worldview as we had.
So that also says that your early customers had to be customers who had already adopted the cloud, who were sold on the cloud value proposition, and your choice of Salesforce.com customers were perfect. So they were perfectly aligned with that psychographic, so you went aggressively after that customer set, right?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And again, but the example that I used, you know, the industry analyst community, you know, not understanding or not believing us and so on, that's a good example that, you know, why you sometimes entrepreneurs need the intuition. You know, I could have gone to analysts and say, you spend, you know, 25 years in this market, you know, tell me, is this you know, is this going to happen or was this going to happen? And analysts would have said no. So that's when I relied on my kind of, you know, experience and intuition. And it needs to be the combination. And then the third thing is picking the right market, because, again, we could have gone to, you know, big banks and they would have said no, we would never give. They still don't give data to the cloud. So you know, relying on intuition, picking the right addressable market, and working with a customer, working with customers with the same view, worldview, was absolutely critical for us.
And that comes to the topic of positioning. I think if you have to get a new concept to market, I personally don't think analysts or investors have the right view. They don't have the intuition, except for a few, unless they really have some very special insight into a market. Typically, they do not have intuition about a new market. And that's a good thing, because if they start developing intuition about the market, then everybody in the industry is going to follow, and you're already a little bit into the, you know, kind of the
lemon.
Everybody wants to invest in this particular insight and this particular trend.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, it's the typical innovator's dilemma. And, you know, there are parts of the establishment who like status quo. That's who they are. So you can never expect that for a truly innovative idea that, you know, it will be received well from some parts of the market. But and as I said, sometimes even customers have different perspective. You know, sometimes customers have their own priorities that don't necessarily align with yours, and that's why product management is so critical for the early stage of the company. There are two very critical, obviously, you know, parts. It's one is ability of the founder to go and sell the ideas to initial customers and VCs. I always believe that it's not only important to have an idea, but being able to sell it is as important, if not more important. But then this kind of notion of you know, very, you know, focused product management that can actually identify what is the common, you know, problem that everybody will want to solve, and what is actually specific to a small group of customers that will never become a big market. That's a big part of the success.
And that lead customer, the early adopter customer set, that is going to be able to understand what you're talking about as an early intuition, is a very, very important part of bringing a new product to market.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us more about Good Data. What are you doing, and what is the secret of the fast growth? Why is the, of course, we just talked about a phase of the company where it was not obvious, and the, it was very much the early adopter game, but that has changed over the last few years. Cloud has become very mainstream. There's huge adoption. People do understand cloud, and of course, cloud now is the buzzword. Everybody wants to invest in cloud, this and cloud, that, and cloud, big data, blah, blah, blah. So what is happening? What are you doing? What's different, and what's causing the traction in your case?
Yeah, so I still remember the first conference I went to when, you know, one of the persons in the audience stood up and said, I would rather give my users no solution than cloud-based solution, you know. So that was the sign what to expect in like 2009. But as you say, you know, things have changed. You know, I believe that the secret of Good Data is the fact that we are very much focused on the outcomes. You know, if you look at the whole big data industry, actually I should say the whole BI and data industry and so on, the outcome is secondary. It's all about the technology. It's all about a tool or toy, or, you know, is it Hadoop one day and MapReduce the next day and Spark the third day and so on. You know, we are very much focused on the outcome. What is it that we actually deliver to our customers? What's the time to value, you know, agility and ROI and so on. And so we are much closer to business applications like ServiceNow and Salesforce in terms of focus on outcome than we are to Oracle's and you know, the Hadoop companies and so on, companies that focus on technology and plumbing and infrastructure. And I think that, you know, our customers really appreciate that focus, and we actually call what we do, we call it insights as a service, because we actually focus on the insights. You know, when I go to my customers, I don't ask them, you know, do you want to buy this version of Hadoop? I ask them, what insights do you want to learn about your business, and how quickly do you need them? And You know, we always say that we start with insights. We don't start with infrastructure.
And your first use case was in the sales intelligence area, sales leads and what is your top use case today? What are your top top insights that you provide, and what areas?
I would actually call it, digital transformation. If you look at what companies do, you know, many major companies do, they move their business processes to digital. You know, Salesforce was only the first step, then marketing was the next step, and you know, customer care. We spoke about the need for customer, you know, good customer care and all of that. So companies are essentially creating kind of the touch points with their prospects and customers, and these touch points are no longer phone and paper and so on. They are more and more digital, and good data helps our customers to connect those touch points. So sales analytics is a small subset of that, but you know, any part of customer journey, from the day customer comes to your website or interfaces with your, you know, social feeds, all the way through, you know, the sales process and implementation process and customer lifecycle, that all generates more and more data, all the way through, you know, call centers and so on. And good data helps to companies to collect all of those touch points and understand, you know, what's the customer journey and where companies can get better at you know, how they actually deal with their customers and prospects.
So, which brings us to the next question, which is about your go-to-market strategy. I know you have used a kind of two-pronged go-to-market strategy. One is direct, you know, inside sales, and then you are also doing OEM. So does that mean that all these different use cases in marketing, in sales, in customer service, are these use cases developed with other vendors who have domain-specific technologies and you do OEM deals with them?
Yeah, exactly. I'm a big believer in these kind of OEM or embedded deals. You know, the world is actually moving into what I would call, and again, that's kind of the intuition that I can share with the audience. And the world is moving in you know, what we would call smart applications. And the smart applications are applications where, you know, data and applications are not separated. You know, if you think about how it used to work in the past, you know, you had your application on screen one and you had your BI tool on screen two, and you look at your customer and you had no idea, you know, you look at your customer profile, for example, and you had no idea, is that customer in a good shape, bad shape, are they going to churn, are they going to buy more? You had to go to another screen and analyze it there, and then you go back to your screen where you actually deal with the customer. The vision is that we will actually integrate applications and data and analytics, so the application will be able to, you know, to predict the customer behavior. And so we absolutely believe in this notion of embedded analytics into the application, and that's why we work with more and more application vendors to help them to enrich the applications with analytics.
And what percentage of your business is these kinds of OEM relationships?
It's about 50% of the business. But again, you know, I do believe that in 10 years you will not see, or maybe in 15 years, you will not see business intelligence as a, you know, separate category. It will actually be subsumed into the applications, that your CRM, your call center, your you know, e-commerce application, they all will have some notion of analytics in them, because that's the way these companies will actually differentiate and make their application better.
You're saying that people in the audience who are building companies, you know, that are technology companies in the area of big data and analytics, should think about OEM strategies as well, that power insights and applications, embedded applications like yours.
And exactly, and the way around, people in the audience who are building business applications should think about how to make them smarter, how to essentially blend the, you know, what good data does into their applications to give their users better experience.
Yeah.
You know, we cannot rely. If you think about, you know, many today's business applications are the still same form-based applications that we had 20 years ago. You know, I don't go to my green fonts terminal screen. I go to web browser, but it's still pretty dumb application in most cases. And what it can make it much faster, much smarter experience is actual analytics.
Yeah, absolutely. So analytics needs to become a feature of every single business application and in context of whatever business problem it's, process it's dealing with.
Absolutely. Yeah. Maybe even feature is kind of even too specific. It's almost like an aspect. You know, feature is a part of the screen. You know, it should be even more blended when, you know, for example, you know, let me give you an example, a good smart application. I use, you know, if you go to Google, they have a Google Now. So Google can tell you, you know, that if you have a meeting on your calendar that you should leave, you know, 20 minutes early because there is a traffic jam. That's analytics combined with calendar. You know, that's not feature of the calendar. It's actually the calendar is acting smartly because there is analytics.
So where are you now? What stage, whatever metric you want to share, what kind of, you know, what kind of penetration do you have into the market? Where are you going from here? I know you raised a lot of money at this point, over $100 million. Have you hit the unicorn valuation mark already?
No, we are a privately owned company, so we don't comment on valuations and revenues and so on. It's really exciting. And for me, the main metric is, you know, the way I measure the company, there are two main metrics. One is predictability. People ask me, when will you go public? And I say, when we will actually get predictable. You know, I always believe that publicly traded companies can only have one surprise, and it's positive surprise. So as long as your business is unpredictable, you should not go public. So I'm working on very much on predictability, how we can deliver every quarter after quarter, you know, good results and only surprise our investors with positive surprise. And I you know, recently hired a very strong CFO, and it's part of the process. And the second measure for my kind of where I am with the company is the NPS, the Net Promoter Score. I absolutely believe that in this world, then the NPS is the primary metric for any CEO. You know, we need to understand how our customers feel about our business, because the penetration in the market cannot be done by only our salespeople. It needs to be done by our customers telling other customers how good the experience is. So I'm you know, measuring and looking at NPS. You know, biweekly, I have a team that actually shares the NPS number with the rest of the company every month. So everybody at Good Data actually knows that you know, where our NPS is, and I can tell you that our NPS is getting better every single month. For the last year, we had every single month a dramatic increase because the whole company is focused on it, and you know, our customers agree.
Good. That's these are, you know, the kind of sense that needs to be sold into the market right now, because the market is quite insane and behaving very, very irrationally. And we like to hear entrepreneurs talk sense.
Thank you.
So last question, Roman. You are from Czechoslovakia. You had, when we talked last, you told me that you had engineering in Czechoslovakia. Do you still have engineering in Czechoslovakia, and how is that working out?
No, yes, we do, and it's working really well. You know, we have locations in Prague and Brno, and it's. I would actually, you know, it's not a huge cost saving. It's, you know, the economics are actually with the dollar, where dollar is today, it's got much better, you know, over the last, I would say, year, 2 years. And, you know, I always joke that at some point it's going to be dirt cheap, but only because of the exchange rate, because the dollar is stronger against any currency in the world. But What I really like about you know, my engineering team is the combination of innovation and stability. You know, you can actually there's a lot of innovation in Silicon Valley, but very little stability. People move around very quickly and so on. And you know, my Czech team is a very stable team, and they work on a hard problem for a long time, and they are very good at it. And so I don't look at it again as a you know, is it an economic model? Can I? It's not kind of offshore model, how to save money. It's a model where we can have a very stable team, making sure that our customers are happy. It goes back again to the notion that the number one goal, you know, what we do is to provide the best experience to our customers, and having a stable team who does it for a long time is part of the solution.
And are you plugged into what's happening in Czechoslovakia around entrepreneurship today?
A little bit. I was there 2 weeks ago, or maybe a month ago, and I spoke in a room full of students. I had like 500 people in the audience. Lots of interesting questions. It's a typical thing coming from the young people. Half of the questions were extremely relevant. You know, the discussions we could have today. The second half of the questions was mostly around how do I become rich really fast, and I cannot help them with that.
So there is an energy and curiosity developing, and not yet probably that many companies developing.
Yeah, no, it's actually the companies are there. You know, that's the thing about the world today. You know, everybody in the world reads TechCrunch. You can assume that every 20 and 22-year-old reads TechCrunch around the world. So, you know, I see companies popping up in every single part of the world, and that's so exciting. And what you do and your programs and so on, you are helping with that. And you know, it's so you should assume that. You know, in every single country in the world, you have an audience, people who want to build companies and want to get to $1 million revenue, even though sometimes it doesn't mean to get rich really quick.
Well, this is the problem that we deal with, actually. Everywhere there's TechCrunch readers and entrepreneurial enthusiasts, but the problem is they all want to get rich quick, and they don't understand that the whole entrepreneurial journey is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's not a rich quick team. It takes many years to build a real company.
Yeah. It's really painful. I actually told them that the entrepreneur might be the worst career choice they actually might have. Risk adjusted, it actually makes almost no sense.
That's true. Well, thank you, Roman. I know you have to go. Thanks for coming, and I'm sure we'll have you back again in a while.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye.